Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents American Discontent, The Rise of Donald Trump and Decline of the Golden Age, by John L. Campbell. Narrated by Peter Burkrot. Preface. I began thinking about this book in March 2016, just as I was heading off to spend a few months at the Copenhagen Business School in Denmark. I had been making that trek for more than a decade, and I knew that my friends and colleagues there would be asking me about the current presidential primary elections in the United States. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were neck and neck in the polls for the Democratic Party nomination. On the Republican side, a large slate of right-wing politicians, including Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, were vying for their party's nomination. Among that group was Donald Trump, a billionaire real estate developer, entrepreneur, and reality television star. Trump was a political upstart who had never run for public office, and seemed to have entered the race on a whim, peppering his campaign speeches with an alarming number of outrageous comments that had rallied the Republican Party's electoral base. Initially, almost nobody believed he would win the nomination, let alone the general election to become the 45th president. But by the time I got to Copenhagen in late March, Trump was leading the Republican field with more than 700 delegates in his pocket, more than half of the 1,200 he needed to win the party's nomination. I braced myself for the following question in Copenhagen. How could a guy like Trump do so well in the primaries? In anticipation of that question, I wrote a short paper before I left home simply to collect my thoughts. I was glad I did, because when I arrived, I was invited to give some seminars and lectures on the subject. More surprising was that total strangers asked me that question too, including a couple sitting next to me and my wife at a concert one night at Jazzhus Montmartre in downtown Copenhagen. During the break, they asked if we were Americans, and when we said yes, they popped the question. People asked me again at conferences that spring in Germany and Austria. The Austrians quizzed me about this because they were facing their own right-wing nationalist political movement, led by Norbert Hofer's Freedom Party of Austria. Hofer won the first round of voting that April, but without a majority faced a runoff, which he eventually lost by a slim margin. One person warned me, referring to Trump's success in the primaries, that this was how fascism started in Europe in the 1930s. I heard similar concerns in Denmark, where the Danish People's Party, founded in 1995, had become an influential presence in Danish politics, thanks to its strong anti-immigrant platform. It had helped support the recent liberal-conservative coalition government, and in 2014 had won the European parliamentary election in Denmark, garnering 27% of the vote in a race with about a half dozen political parties. The paper I wrote that spring for the Danes turned out to be the skeleton for this book, although I didn't plan to write a book at the time. After all, there was no way, I thought, that Donald Trump would win. I figured he was just a flash in the pan. But by election day in November, things had changed dramatically. Trump had won the Republican nomination and was only about 3 points behind Clinton in most polls. As luck would have it, I was in Washington, D.C. that election day, with a group of high-level Danish civil servants and business people. Reminiscent of my experiences earlier that spring, the Danes wanted to know how Trump had gotten this far, and whether he could win the presidency that day. I had some tentative answers to the first question, but was emphatic in my answer to the second. No, I would be shocked if he won. I wasn't the only one of that opinion. We all went to a local restaurant for dinner that evening and watched the election returns come in on CNN. On the way to the restaurant, we passed several busy intersections, each one manned by lots of police astride motorcycles, fully armed, helmeted, wearing bulletproof vests, and just waiting. But for what? Trump had warned repeatedly that the election was rigged against him, and that if he lost that night, his supporters would riot in the streets. It appeared that the Metropolitan Police in D.C. were taking that warning very seriously. They seemed to think Trump might lose, too. At the restaurant, an initial spirit of excitement gave way to nervousness, and then disbelief. as the returns rolled in and it started to become clear that Trump might win. Dinner broke up at about 10 o'clock p.m., and some of us walked back to the hotel in Georgetown. The motorcycle cops were long gone. No riots that night. People had congregated on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House, and in Lafayette Square across the street. The mood was somber when we walked by. By the time I went to bed around midnight, the election hadn't officially been called, but it was clear who would win. I awoke twice during the night and checked the TV to see if it was officially over. By breakfast time, Trump had declared victory. Just before lunch, Clinton went on national television and delivered a gracious yet impassioned concession speech, urging young women never to give up their dreams. That afternoon, the Danes and I attended a symposium on the election at the Brookings Institute, where both Republicans and Democrats on the dais were nearly at a loss for words trying to explain how it had all happened, and especially in trying to predict what lay ahead. But they all agreed that the next 4 years could very easily become one of the most serious tests in history of the U.S. Constitution's capacity to check the power of the presidency. After all, Trump would enjoy a Republican-controlled Congress, and very likely a conservative Supreme Court, once he had a chance to fill the seat vacated by the death several months earlier of Justice Antonin Scalia. By dinner time, I had decided that the paper I had written earlier that spring should become a book. Let me be clear from the start. I find Trump's rise to power very disturbing, as do most Democrats. However, so do many Republicans, including some in Congress. The 2016 election was unlike anything in recent memory, and Trump was an extraordinarily different kind of politician than people were used to seeing. His campaign speeches, press releases, and advertisements were loaded with factually incorrect and misleading information. Politicians often play fast and loose with the truth, but Trump's flair for distorting and misrepresenting it, intentionally or not, was astonishing. Moreover, his campaign rhetoric was often offensive. He insulted Mexicans, Muslims, African Americans, immigrants, women, America's military generals, and one war hero, Senator John McCain, who as a Navy pilot during the Vietnam War was shot down over Hanoi, captured, tortured, and imprisoned for over 5 years by the North Vietnamese. However, as Trump put it, he's not a war hero. He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured. Finally, Trump was the first true outsider to win the White House in over a century. The wealthiest populace the nation had ever seen. A contradiction in terms, to be sure, but one that appealed to millions of voters. While being an outsider helped him win the election, it was an albatross around his neck once in office. His inexperience very quickly looked like incompetence as things got off to a very rocky start. Consider his first few months in office. He approved a botched military raid in Yemen that killed a Navy SEAL. Both Trump and his team issued several falsehoods, including his subsequently discredited Twitter charge that Barack Obama had tapped his phones in Trump Tower during the campaign. He issued a much-publicized executive order banning entry to the United States for people coming from 7 predominantly Muslim countries, a move that sparked nationwide protests at airports, and that the courts quickly blocked as unconstitutional. Several top administrative and cabinet nominees, including Vincent Viola for Secretary of the Army and Philip Bilden for Secretary of the Navy, withdrew from consideration amid controversy over ethics issues regarding their personal finances. Andrew Puzder, Trump's nominee for Secretary of Labor, also withdrew when it became clear that several Senate Republicans would not support him due to his anti-labor practices as CEO of CKE Restaurants, parent company of the fast food chains Carl's Jr. and Hardee's. Michael Flynn, Trump's national security advisor, was forced to resign when it was revealed that he had apparently lied to the vice president-elect about his contact with the Russian ambassador during the presidential transition. Committees in both houses of Congress had already launched investigations into possible Russian computer hacking, designed to help Trump win the election. They were also looking at possible collusion between the Russians and Trump's associates during the transition, including Flynn and Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chairperson. The FBI was looking into it, too. It turned out later that Trump had pressured FBI Director James Comey to pull back on the Bureau's investigation and go easy on Flynn, a move that some thought amounted to obstruction of justice, an impeachable offense. Soon thereafter, he fired Comey. As a result, the Deputy Attorney General appointed a special prosecutor, former FBI Director Robert Mueller, to investigate. There were also accusations that Trump was violating the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution by benefiting financially from foreign dignitaries staying at his hotels. And then one of Trump's major campaign promises to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, ACA, otherwise known as Obamacare, as soon as he took office, hit the rocks. It turned out that Trump didn't have a replacement plan after all, so he left it up to Congress to figure out. Given all this, it wasn't surprising that Trump's approval ratings quickly sank to the lowest level of any new president in modern American history, 35% by late March in a Gallup survey. According to Steve Schmidt, a longtime Republican strategist and advisor to former Vice President Dick Cheney, no administration has ever been off to a worse 100-day start. Things didn't get much better after that. The Russian collusion scandal deepened, implicating Trump's eldest son, Donald Jr., and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who now also worked in the White House as a senior advisor. Congress failed spectacularly to repeal the ACA, and several top White House staff were forced to resign, including Press Secretary Sean Spicer, Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, Communications Director Mike Dubke, and then his replacement, Anthony Scaramucci, hired by Trump only to be fired 10 days later by Trump's new chief of staff. Also departing during the first year were Assistant Press Secretary Michael Short, Advisor Sebastian Gorka, Deputy National Security Advisor Katie McFarland, Deputy Chief of Staff Katie Walsh, Senior Director for Intelligence at the National Security Council, NSC, Ezra Cohen Watnick, Deputy Chief of Staff at the NSC, Tara Dahl, Middle East Advisor at the NSC, Derek Harvey, and Director in the NSC Strategic Planning Office, Rich Higgins. Presidential historians said they had to go all the way back to the 19th century to find an administration as crippled with infighting and legislative disarray as Trump's, and Trump's approval ratings remained stuck at historic lows. It wasn't just the people who voted for Clinton that disapproved of Trump's performance. Some of those who had voted for Trump were beginning to ask themselves if they had made a mistake. My wife and I were sitting at the bar in a local restaurant having dinner one evening, about 3 weeks into Trump's presidency. A local contractor, born and raised in our small New Hampshire town, sat down next to us, and the conversation quickly turned to national politics. He confessed that he had voted for Trump and had been willing to give him the benefit of the doubt for a while, but was now having second thoughts. He was particularly worried that under Trump's administration he would lose his health insurance, which he said he had received thanks to the ACA. He wasn't alone in his concerns. A special Twitter site was established for disgruntled Trump voters to post their regrets. It was full of complaints, for example, about his appointing more billionaires to high positions than any other president, putting people in top administrative posts who had no experience running large bureaucracies, and nominating people with no policy expertise in the jobs for which they had been chosen. People also grumbled about his kowtowing to the Russians, tweeting ad nauseam in ways unbecoming of the office of the president, and trying to replace the ACA with something that, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would have caused millions of Americans to lose their health insurance. Lots of Trump voters were beginning to suffer from buyer's remorse. The point is that I am writing this book both for those who supported Trump and for those who did not, Republicans and Democrats. We all need to understand what the forces were that propelled someone like this so rapidly and so unexpectedly to the pinnacle of political power in America. We need to understand that Trump's rise to power was the culmination of deep trends in American society that had been developing for decades. As the saying goes, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. In writing this book, I have benefited from conversations with and comments from many friends and colleagues. I apologize to those whose names I have inadvertently left out, and take sole responsibility for any errors I may have committed. An especially important disclaimer in today's highly charged political climate, where alternative facts and fake news permeate the atmosphere. My thanks go to Michael Allen, Jeff Crawford, Christian DeCock, Mark Dixon, Bill Domhoff, Francesco Duina, Nils Fulsang, Christina Gomez, Lev Grinberg, John Hall, Brooke Harrington, Jason Hull, Larry Isaac, Lars Bo Kasperson, Claudia Kern, Phil Kern, Mart Lutzat, Catherine Lively, John McKinley, Ove Peterson, Chuck Sherman, Kathy Sharib, Antje Vetterlein, and Emily Walton. Eddie Ashby provided an especially helpful sounding board, often challenging my arguments and forcing me to improve them. I also received many helpful comments when I presented versions of the argument in seminars at Copenhagen University, Copenhagen Business School, the University of Southern Denmark, and Dartmouth College. Finally, three anonymous reviewers from Oxford University Press also provided invaluable suggestions, as did James Cook, my editor. My wife, Kathy Sharib, and daughter, Jessica Sharib, were among the hundreds of thousands of protesters in Washington, D.C. on January 21, 2016, a day after the inauguration, demanding that the new Trump administration show tolerance and respect for the law and women's rights. Their activism was a major inspiration for this book. John Campbell, Lyme, New Hampshire, September 2017. A note on sources, alternative facts, and fake news. Then I'll get down on my knees and pray. We don't get fooled again. In his best-selling book, The Art of the Deal, Donald Trump wrote that one of his favorite rhetorical tools is what he called truthful hyperbole. He maintained that this was an innocent form of exaggeration, and a very useful marketing strategy that he first developed for Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue in New York City. The building has a large ground floor atrium, and then 19 commercial floors above it, before the residential floors begin. However, the first residential floor is numbered the 30th floor, not the 20th. Why skip 10 floors when numbering them? According to Trump, it makes the building sound bigger than it is, 68 rather than 58 floors. Moreover, people are willing to pay more for apartments on higher floors, which have higher status in the world of luxury condominiums. This proved to be a very successful marketing strategy that he and other real estate developers have used many times since. In fact, the phrase truthful hyperbole is a contradiction in terms. You cannot be truthful while engaging in hyperbole, which, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is an extravagant statement used to express strong feeling or produce a strong impression, and that people should not take literally. Often on the campaign trail, Trump would say things, perhaps as truthful hyperbole, that fact-checkers and others would criticize later for being inaccurate. This became so common that people began saying that we had entered a post-truth world, where down was up and up was down. This continued after the election, even from his staff. Sean Spicer, Trump's press secretary, announced that Trump's was the largest crowd ever to gather on the Mall and watch a presidential inauguration, a claim that was soon debunked by official crowd estimates and aerial photography. When questioned about this a few days later by a television reporter on NBC's Meet the Press, Trump's senior advisor, Kellyanne Conway, defended the claim, saying that Spicer was simply reporting alternative facts. As I was writing this book, I was invited to a one-day conference on fake news and alternative facts held at Harvard Law School. It was the most disturbing conference I have ever attended. Fake news is fabricated or misleading news, often coming from professional-looking websites that are run by people who do not subscribe to the normal standards of professional journalism. They distort the facts, make lots of stuff up, and pass it along as being true and newsworthy. There were three panels at the conference composed of respected academics from around the country, and professionals from the BBC, Microsoft Research, factcheck.org, and Twitter. One panel was about why people believe what they believe. One was about how fake news is disseminated. And one was about what we can do to combat fake news. I learned two very important lessons at the conference. First, we tend to believe things that we hear repeatedly, especially if we hear them from people we know or trust, even if they don't have the faintest idea what they're talking about and what they say makes little sense. Many psychologists and political scientists have documented this empirically over the years, including some people on the Harvard panels. But I suspect that there is more to it than that. My hunch is that Americans also tend to believe much of what they hear or read repeatedly for two additional reasons. One is the American educational system. As one panelist at the conference put it, our school system does a lousy job of teaching students how to think critically about what they read and hear. Indeed, many people worry that American students are mediocre by international standards when it comes to reading, math, and science, and that in some of these areas, American kids are falling behind their peers in other countries. Without critical thinking, alternative facts and fake news pass unquestioned. Of course, not all our students are mediocre, but the vast inequality in school systems across the country means that some students are much more likely to learn critical thinking skills than others are. Economist Peter Temin argues that we have a dual education system in America, where, due to a lack of resources, schools in lower-income neighborhoods are failing students, while those at the other end of the spectrum with more resources do better. Let me be clear on this. I am not arguing that poor people are less intelligent than rich people, or that Trump supporters are stupid. There is a difference between intelligence, which is the ability to grasp and understand facts, and critical thinking, which is the capacity to contemplate and evaluate those facts, and to imagine alternative explanations and scenarios for them. Whether our educational system encourages and enhances critical thinking rather than just intelligent understanding has been in question for a long time. There is also an emotional reason we tend to believe things without question, especially when it comes to politics. As sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild found in her conversations about politics with downtrodden working-class conservatives in Louisiana, folks that were likely Trump fans, people tend to believe what makes them feel good. And what makes them feel good is often what resonates with and affirms what they already believe. She found that people often disregard facts if they contradict their feelings and beliefs, which may be one reason they vote against their interests. For example, many of the people she interviewed were deeply religious. Their belief in God made them feel good because it gave them great emotional comfort and moral strength to endure the economic and other hardships they suffered. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Richard Hofstadter showed that in America, religious beliefs have often been at odds with critical thinking. After all, believing in God is a matter of faith, not fact. It makes sense, then, that when politicians, Tea Party activists, or Fox News commentators appeal to people's beliefs in God, or for that matter, any emotional issue, as they often do, it may cloud people's ability to evaluate the facts and other information they are hearing. The second lesson I took away from the Harvard conference was that people are getting their news more and more frequently from social media like Facebook and Twitter, where they tend to communicate with people like themselves, people they tend to know and trust. One panelist presented an analysis of over 1 million media references that people had posted on their Twitter and Facebook accounts. Early in the presidential campaign, those references tended to be from mainstream media sites like The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, CNN, and network television news programs. In other words, postings of both center-left and center-right news sources were common. But as the campaign unfolded, these sources faded into the background, while references to extreme right-wing sources with a proclivity for trafficking in fake news became more prominent. Topping the list of the most frequently mentioned sources were those from the Breitbart News Network and Fox News. There wasn't much comparable emerging on the left. You may know that Rupert Murdoch, a very conservative and very wealthy Australian-born American media mogul, established Fox News. His empire also includes News Corp, 21st Century Fox, the large publishing house HarperCollins, and the Wall Street Journal. You probably know less about Breitbart, which Andrew Breitbart started in 2005 as Breitbart.com. Breitbart was a conservative who, ironically, had helped Arianna Huffington start the liberal Huffington Post. His idea was to create a website that would counter the so-called liberal media bias, occasionally, as it turned out, with vulgar anti-Semitic and Islamophobic views. He died suddenly of a heart attack at age 43, but his website lived on. Libertarian hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer gave $10 million to Steve Bannon, eventually Donald Trump's senior White House advisor, to help subsidize Breitbart. It is now the 29th most popular website in America, has 2 billion page visits a year, and is bigger than the Huffington Post, its inspiration, and Pornhub. It is the biggest political site on both Facebook and Twitter. However, that's just the beginning. Mercer and his friends also seem to have their hands on other internet sources of alternative facts and fake news. Before the 2016 election, a group of people bought several hundred internet domain names at considerable cost to weaponize certain ideas. The plan was to repeatedly blast out certain messages in coordinated fashion so that people believed them. One ideational carpet-bombing network was set up during the election to saturate the public with pro-Trump information. We also know, according to testimony before the Senate by James Clapper, former director of National Intelligence, that the Russians engaged in these tactics too during the 2016 election, using social media to spread fake news and pro-Trump messages. The point is that we need to be very careful these days when considering what's true and what's not. It's all too easy to find ourselves stuck in an echo chamber, where we hear or read the same things repeatedly, and where we believe people we talk and listen to simply because what they say resonates with what we already think and makes us feel good regardless of the truth. I have tried very hard not to write a book based on truthful hyperbole, alternative facts, or fake news. I have drawn my facts from many sources that most people would take as truthful. These include a variety of U.S. government reports and databases, reputable news sources, including, for example, The New York Times, The Economist, and CNN. Well-regarded public opinion polling organizations like Gallup and Pew Research, and several articles and books by respected scholars and professional journalists. In this way, I have tried to separate fiction from truth, and fake news from the real McCoy. Chapter 1. How did this happen? This is not just a story about Donald Trump's ascendance to the presidency of the United States. It's a story about America. It's a story about the decline of civil and sensible politics, and their replacement with something much more divisive that may very well threaten U.S. hegemony. It's a story about several long-developing economic, racial, ideological, and political trends in America that created the public discontent that Trump exploited to win the presidency of the United States. Trump made billions of dollars building skyscrapers, high-end resorts, and golf courses, selling his brand and creating and starring in a popular reality television show. He had no political experience, either running for or holding public office. His campaign was disorganized and poorly funded by conventional standards. His policy positions were ill-defined and vague, and often boiled down to pithy soundbites like, "We'll build a wall," which summed up a good deal of his views on how to handle the country's problems of immigration and job loss. During the campaign, he promised to renegotiate various free trade agreements, pursue protectionist policies, and clamp down on immigration to the United States of Muslims, and especially Syrian refugees, whom he considered to be the Trojan horse of radical Islamic terrorism. He also pledged to rethink America's commitment to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and make deals with Vladimir Putin, Russia's president, whose leadership he said he admired. His campaign was riddled with racist, misogynist, xenophobic, and nationalist hyperbole. Many of his views were transmitted instantly in 140 characters or less to his millions of Twitter followers. It was unorthodox, but it worked. Why? He was a pitchman extraordinaire in the right place.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?